everyone, Jody here. It is hard to believe, but we are already into holiday season for 2021. So over the next month or so, we're going to keep doing new shows. And we've also got some really cool end of year specials planned. We're also going to give ourselves a little bit of time off. And so during those stretches, we will run back some of our favorite conversations from the year. Okay, let's get into it. Here's one of our favorite episodes from 2021. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, March 11th, 1861, the Constitution of the Confederate States is adopted. The Southern states, of course, were fighting to secede, set up their own country, and, well, they needed a constitution. And we're going to get into this, but the CSA Constitution is a really interesting document in terms of what values it puts at its core, the very things that were tearing the country apart at that time. But it's also a bit of a constitutional do-over. Many of the changes in the CSA Constitution were just relatively neutral updates and clarifications and new ideas about how government could run. It's a weird thing to say, but maybe there are some things in the Constitution of the Confederate States of America that we may want to think about these days. So let's do that. Here to discuss, as always, is Nicole Hammer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
So Kelly, let's actually start with a big question, which is, if we consider a constitution to be, in a sense, an expression of values, it obviously sets out a lot of sort of rules and norms, but if we think of it as an expression of values, what in the CSA Constitution is being expressed as core values as you see it?
Well, I think the underlying message is always white supremacy. I mean, that's first and foremost. But I also think that this is a much more religious document as well, that God is sort of dropped in into different aspects of the Constitution that weren't included in the United States Constitution. I also think that slavery plays more of a stronger role in this as well. Instead of talking about, you know, free or non-free persons, they explicitly use the word slaves.
Yep.
And I think that matters, too.
Yeah. And in addition to using the word slaves, they also expressly forbid the ending of the ability to enslave people in the Constitution itself. And this value of slavery, right, that's what we're writing this this document to protect, is related to that other value that you're pointing out, Kelly, of God. Right, because they had developed over the course of the early 19th century this religious defense of slavery, that it was part of the right and just moral order. And so in many ways, the writers of the Confederate Constitution were like, all right, the original Constitution has some flaws, and its big flaws are it was written by deists and by people who are a little skeptical of the long-term health of slavery for the country. And so let's fix those two things.
And we should clarify that, you know, this was largely based on the existing U.S. Constitution. And again, as we're starting to describe, it's those moments where words get changed, clauses get taken out or added that show you the expression of values. Do either of you have a sense of whether there was a thought of a sort of whole cloth, let's start new, we're a new country, or was it really let's do the you know, the word markup suggest changes?
I really think you know, when we think about the structure of the U.S. Constitution, it really is a genius document in a lot of ways. I don't think they were interested in necessarily reinventing the wheel. I think they wanted to simply emphasize what was important to them. So it's not necessarily important to try to create something completely different. The goal was to try to enforce the values that they believe should have been at the center of this document from the jump.
Yeah, and there are a lot of practical reasons, too. I mean, for on the one hand, they're trying to claim that they're the true heirs of the spirit of the American Revolution. So this is their constitution. They just needed to tweak it because there were some errors in the original version. But also, it takes a long time to write a constitution. They needed a constitution as a way of signaling that they were a legitimate government and a legitimate country, and they needed to get on the hop with that. And the best way that you do that is you take the U.S. Constitution and you just make a few tweaks,
cut,
and you go forward
paste.
Exactly.
So this is a very fraught question, but my job is to naively ask the fraught questions. But, you know, why is this not, when you read it, why is it not just a full-throated defense of slavery? Why are there these sort of workarounds, if you want to call it that, of slavery refracted through religious liberty or states' rights? Mm. You know, there's part of me that feels like a little surprised that there isn't just very explicit language.
Mm. You know, I think that the explicit language that we're all expecting to see was some of the language that was used when states start to secede from the nation. They make it very clear. You know, if you read the secession documents from the state of Mississippi or South Carolina, it's very clear what their intent is and why they're leaving and why they are trying to protect their enslaved property. But I think when they're trying to think outside of, this is not just about secession, this is how we will form our country, or how our country, the foundation of what our country will be based on, I don't think they saw it was as necessary to be as heavy-handed, because it was all implied for them that slavery would be at the core of it. So it's there, but it doesn't necessarily have to explain their entire existence.
And they saw these theories like states' rights and religion as shoring up the institution of slavery, even though the Constitution obviously expressly overrides some states' rights by saying that you can't outlaw slavery. But another good document to look at if you want to understand that it was understood what this new document was about is that the very famous speech by Alexander Stevens, who would become the vice president of the Confederacy, his cornerstone speech, was actually a speech that he gave in defense or in promotion of this new Constitution. And he makes very explicit in that speech, slavery, white supremacy, these are the cornerstone values of this new country. I am telling you this right now, right? Just like the Federalist Papers sort of like made the case for the original Constitution, this speech just makes clear, in case people don't take their time to read this legal document, exactly what the Confederacy stands for and what this Constitution protects.
Mm-hmm. And I should make clear, too, that the fugitive slave law is still intact. I mean, that is a principle that they still wanted to make sure went in the document as well, to signal to the enslaved, hey, listen, if you run away, we will still come after you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this point about states' rights and how that gets balanced is really interesting, because it's like maybe emphasizing states' rights a little bit more, but only when states' rights perfectly align with the overall goal of the new country. And so, yes, taking away the ability of states to grant voting rights to non-citizens or to trade freely with each other. There are some other clauses in here about slave trading as well, right?
Yeah, so they still ban the slave trade. So they're not interested in making trips back to Africa or trading, you know, or picking back up the slave trade where it left off. The slave trade was closed in 1807, 1808, and so that for them was not something that they were going to pick up again. But that does not mean that slave trading was not still in full effect, trade across states and all of that was still very much in play.
And the reason that they were doing that is, in one way, to protect their investment so the market wouldn't be glutted with new enslaved people. And because by that point, they had a growing population of enslaved people because of the birth rate. And so they were like, actually, this is working out well for us. Mm. This population will continue to grow, but it won't be flooded with new people who are part of the trade.
I want to get to some of the other ways in which this document comes together, because there are some more, let's call them, I guess, like technical or procedural changes here that again, as I said, you know, feel like it's this document is a bit of a do-over in terms of just cleaning up the language. And so putting aside these larger issues of states' rights and God and slavery, you know, just a little bit more of, hey, this document can work a little better. So, you know, maybe we can go through a few of those. And I suppose, Nikki, the place we have to start is they clean up what I think many people think is the most problematic comma in the history of the world, which is that very confusingly placed comma in the Second Amendment.
Yes. People in the 18th century were very free with their punctuation. They just sort of sprinkled it wherever they felt they should put it. And in fact, English common law made clear that you don't actually pay attention to punctuation in laws because it doesn't mean anything because there is no standardization. But the way that the commas are placed in the Second Amendment opened the door for people who want to push for greater gun rights. And in fact, was the underlying argument in the 2008 case that the Supreme Court recognized gun rights as an individual right, and they put it all on one of those three commas in the Second Amendment. I don't think it's the comma's fault. I think it's Justice Scalia's fault, but so, the comma gets the blame.
So the Second Amendment, as it reads in the U.S. Constitution, is a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to be to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, mm-hmm. comma, shall not be infringed. And it's that first comma after a well-regulated militia that opens the door for people to say basically everything before the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed is throat clearing.
Yeah.
The militia stuff and the gun stuff are not actually related to each other.
Yeah.
Now, what do the Confederate States of America do with those many confusing punctuation marks?
They take them out. Just take that out. We don't need that. You know, I mean, and in that way, they're also making it very explicit. And I have talked about this in other areas before, that the Second Amendment and white supremacy go hand in hand, or I should say the Second Amendment and race go hand in hand. And it was always made clear that the ability to own guns was something that was only included white men for the most part. And so by being explicit about that, they're letting people know, like, who's entitled to this power? Who's entitled to gun ownership? That means everything. And they
and that's mm-hmm. because they more closely tied it, made it more explicit. This was tied to the formation of a militia, and the only people who could form militias were free white men.
Sure. And, you know, gun ownership is an extension of white supremacy in a lot of ways. And I think that gets reinforced by removing these commas.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the first things after the Civil War that the white South does after emancipation is to pass laws that say black people cannot have guns or knives or anything that might possibly be construed as a weapon.
Okay, so there's some cleaning up of punctuation there. What other kind of more procedural stuff catches your eye?
Well, for me, I think it's the term. The president's term is about 6 years long in this new constitution. He also has he or she, but presumably he.
Well, let's be real.
has a line item veto that I think is also important, along with other, you know, various fiscal restraints, I think matters. And then, you know, the ability of the cabinet members to answer questions on the floor of the Congress were all considered innovative and you know, neutral ideas that might still be worth talking about today, I think.
Yeah. There was also a ban put on recess appointments, and that just came out of, in the 19th century, because Congress wasn't in session all that often, there were tons of recess appointments, and people got really angry about it. And this is a good time to remind everyone that people like Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy, had been in the Senate, and I'm sure that he and these other guys had some real problems that they experienced when they were working in Congress, and they were like, hey, here's a chance to fix some of those things.
Interesting. Yeah. So as we start to wrap up, I mean, I want to ask on the technical side, but then on the big think side, kind of what do we make of this document, and does it have any lessons or ideas that are worth sort of considering today? So on the more technical stuff, I mean, I think we're all fans of clearer punctuation. So maybe that's something that we could take from the Confederate States of America Constitution. Anything else in here that you feel like, you know, might be worth tapping Mitch McConnell on the shoulder and saying, hey, you know, check this out.
Look, I think that more than particular ideas that they float, I think that the real takeaway is even in the 1860s, people realized that the Constitution was kind of a mess and needed to be cleaned up. Right. And I think that's what a lot of those procedural things point to, and the punctuation and clarifying the spelling. Like, a lot of it was like, this document was written in the late 19th century. It is not sacrosanct. Let's make some changes to make it fit what we have learned over the past 70 years or so of its existence. And I wouldn't suggest that we use the Confederate Constitution as a model for revisions to the Constitution, but mm-hmm. I think that the reminder that updating the thing would be nice is a good idea.
I'll say that during the abolitionist movement, William Lloyd Garrison, famous white abolitionist, is known for setting the Constitution on fire and for basically saying this is a pro-slavery document. And when you think that the changes that are made by the CSA are significant, but not drastic in terms of how they recreate or make amendments to what they think should be emphasized, I think that says something even more powerful, that they didn't need to tweak it that much. You would think if you're going to form an entirely new country based off the institution of slavery, there might need to be major revisions made. And we don't necessarily see that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point to underscore. When they were like, how do we make this a more pro-slavery document? They looked at it and they were like, a few phrases here and there, that should do it.
Yeah. Instead of here, year of our Lord. Right.
But yeah, it makes you rethink the values that are at the heart of our existing Constitution. And then it also emphasizes that so much of it is, you know, you bring your own values and into your interpretation of it. And, you know, these are documents that are as much reflections as they are expressions. And
you bring your own set of meanings to those commas.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Well, we certainly do. All right. Well, that is a great place to leave it. You know, this is super fascinating. I do want to do one also on this day, which, I will say we are entering a month where this is going to happen all the time. But this day in 2020 was the day that the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic. And I just want to acknowledge that obviously the month of March and ongoing is going to be just like full of these like, oh, right, one year ago, so forth, including we're hurtling towards the 1 year anniversary of starting this podcast, which is very high on the list of important things that happened in 2020, obviously. But, you know, at some point we'll launch our spinoff show, This Day in Esoteric Last Year. I think
there's going to be plenty of material.
Oh yeah, my gosh.
Yeah. I know. And then it'll be like the snake eating its tail thing we're just talking about. Yeah.
Pretty much.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. Follow us on social media. We're at This Day Pod on Instagram and Twitter. Get in touch with any questions or comments about the show, thisdaypod@gmail.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.